From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, he's back. Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld is a Republican again, and he might run for office again, this time against President Donald Trump.
I'm here actually because I think our country is in grave peril, and I cannot sit any longer quietly on the sidelines.
Also today, President Trump declares a national emergency in a controversial effort to fund his wall on the southern border.
It's a great thing to do because we have an invasion of drugs, invasion of gangs, invasion of people, and it's unacceptable.
It's all part of our Week in Review. Plus, Melvin Miller and the Bay State Banner, chronicling the challenges and the successes of Boston's black community.
To be cast as losers, we have focused so much on that that we have almost induced the media to record us as victims. We're a city of winners.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's begin today with presidential politics and another Massachusetts politician who says he's considering a run for president.
We cannot sit passively as our precious democracy slips quietly into darkness. Congress must do its duty, and as citizens, we must do ours.
That's Bill Weld, the former two-term governor of Massachusetts, announcing today in New Hampshire that he's launching a presidential exploratory committee. So he could become the first Republican to challenge President Donald Trump. In 2016, Weld abandoned the Republican Party and ran for vice president as a libertarian. But now he's back in the GOP, saying the country is in grave danger. He calls Trump a nativist, a schoolyard bully, and too unstable to be president.
We have a president whose priorities are skewed towards promotion of himself rather than toward the good of the country. He may have great energy and considerable raw talent, but he does not use them in ways that promote democracy, truth, justice, and equal opportunity for all.
If he decides to pursue the Republican nomination, Weld would face a big challenge. He represents the moderate wing of the Republican Party at a time when large majorities of Republicans support the president. Here's Stephen Stepanek, chairman of the New Hampshire Republican State Committee.
I believe that in a Republican primary, the president is going to get 95%+ no matter who runs against him.
On the other hand, a Morning Consult poll released this week found that a third of Republicans support a primary challenge to the president. So Weld would be counting on the support of moderate Republicans like Fergus Cullen, the former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party, who has opposed Trump from the start and joins us now. And Fergus Cullen, good to have you. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And also joining us is former Massachusetts state rep and Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, Jeff Diehl. Jeff Diehl also chaired the Trump presidential campaign in Massachusetts in 2016. I should say co-chaired that campaign. Jeff Diehl, thank you for joining us.
Anthony, Fergus, good to be here.
Good to have you both. So let me start with you, Fergus Cullen, up there in New Hampshire. What's your reaction to Weld's challenge to President Trump?
Boy, gratitude. What a breath of fresh air. I had the opportunity to visit with Governor Weld earlier today as well and thanked him for being willing to say publicly what many, many Republicans think privately or talk to each other about when reporters aren't necessarily around. Listen, this president has been a chaotic president for 2 years. He's been not up to the job. I think we're lucky we haven't had a bigger disaster. And he knows that there have been five presidents who have been challenged in the New Hampshire primary seriously, and none of those five ended up reelected. That goes back to Truman. It includes President Johnson, Carter. It includes President Ford, and it includes President Bush, 41, most recently in 1992.
Now, Jeff Diehl, I know, of course, you're a supporter of the president's. Do you think this candidacy by William Weld, this potential candidacy, we should say, by Weld, represents a serious challenge to the president?
Well, I've got gratitude for him getting in as well. I think that this basically shows that he'll get that token opposition that will really go nowhere. And I think that will give the president a chance to describe exactly what's going on with our country today, a robust economy, stronger partners overseas. And I think it's going to give him a chance to, again, revamp his campaign and get ready for the Democrat challenger in a way that's really not threatening.
So, Fergus, this leads to my next question to you. Can Bill Weld win? I mean, he was a highly regarded two-term governor of Massachusetts, but since then he hasn't really been successful. He lost a Senate race against John Kerry. Then he left office in 2006. He ran unsuccessfully for governor of New York. Last year, he abandoned the Republican Party, ran for vice president as a libertarian. I mean, is this the guy to take on Donald Trump?
Well, I think that when Pat Buchanan ran in 1992, half the people who ended up supporting him really believed in Pat Buchanan, and the other half were looking for a messenger that they could use to send a message that they were dissatisfied with the trajectory of the current administration at that time, how they were handling things. So this isn't really about ideology. You know, I think the idea that this is a conservative versus a moderate is just not true. First of all, I don't agree that President Trump is conservative at all. He has no ideology, no compass whatsoever when it comes to that. So, you know, make the case. Come to New Hampshire, where independents are allowed to vote in the primary as well, and make the case for why this president has been a failure, has been dangerous for our country, is not a role model for our children, and that we've been lucky that we haven't had a bigger crisis under his watch.
So, Jeff, I want you to pick up on Fergus's point. I mean, New Hampshire, the sort of key constituency up there, independents are a big group of folks. If Weld is going to do well, obviously he needs to peel off some Republicans, but it's that big group of independence that he might appeal to. What do you think?
Well, look, I think I look at my race as a potential indicator of how New Hampshire is going to go. First of all, New Hampshire used to be more conservative. As you know, you get more liberal Democrats moving into New Hampshire over the years. It's gone a little bit further to the left, so it's not the lock that it used to be for Republican candidates. But in this case, you know, you look at my campaign, I had two opponents in my Republican primary. One of them, John Kingston, had funded Evan McMullen to run as an independent to try to knock Trump out, take away Utah in the 16 primary. He got 26 or 27% versus me. And the other person who ran against me had been affiliated with the Republican Party and you know, for a long time. So I think Massachusetts is any indicator of the sentiment of Republicans towards someone who supports Trump, you're going to see a similar result up in New Hampshire. And look, Trump right now is at 89% approval within the Republican Party while Weld's going after him. If you looked at Bush back when Buchanan took him on, he was only at 73% approval. So, I mean, it's still a different story overall. And Bush did have the no new taxes pledge, which he, you know, obviously backtracked on. So I think Trump, again, is showing that, you know, he's trying to live up to all the campaign promises he made. And right now, you know, when pocketbook issues tend to dominate in the final months of the race, both the primary and the general election, I think he's going to prove that he's done everything he said he was going to do.
Fergus, wouldn't many Republicans in New Hampshire regard Weld skeptically, given that he abandoned the Republican Party last year or a couple of years ago, proclaiming himself free at last? I guess he did that last year. And so, for example, here's Stephen Stepanek, the current chair of your state's GOP.
You question his credentials as a Republican because in 2016, he was a candidate for vice president of the Libertarian Party, and now he's turned his back on the Libertarian Party as he turned his back on the Republican Party. So my first inclination is you can't believe anything he says.
So, of course, I misspoke there. Of course, he abandoned the Republican Party in 2016, not last year. But Fergus, respond to that. Respond to the concerns there that Stephen Stepanek raises.
I mean, I question President Trump's credentials as a Republican. This is a guy who switched party affiliations five times in his life, only became a Republican most recently in 2012, donated to Hillary Clinton, donated to Chuck Schumer, donated to Kamala Harris. I mean, the idea that this guy is some kind of paragon of Republican virtue is just garbage.
Yeah, interesting. Jeff Deal, I gave Fergus Cullen the first word. I'll give you the last word in this back and forth. And I appreciate the debate.
No, sure. And look, I don't think the voters of New Hampshire are ever going to forget the fact that ultimately Bill Weld endorsed President Obama over John McCain. I don't think they are going to forget that he endorsed Hillary Clinton over President Trump. You know, this is a Republican primary. New Hampshire still does tend to, I think, ultimately in primaries, pick someone who is loyal to that party. And I think Trump has tried to prove during his time in office that he is delivering on the promises he made to those Republican voters.
All right. Well, Jeff Diehl, former state rep and Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Fergus Cullen, the former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party. Thanks as well for you. Thanks as well to you for talking about Bill Weld's chances up there in New Hampshire. It'll be interesting to watch. Thanks, Fergus.
Anthony. Thanks, Jeff.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll look at some of the biggest stories of the week, including that Weld's potential presence in the 2020 race with our Week in Review panelists. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Friday, so let's turn right to our Week in Review, and we'll start with yet another big week in politics. Today, President Trump said he will sign the budget deal that Congress passed to avoid another government shutdown. The president also declared a national emergency in an effort to build the wall.
We're going to be signing today and registering national emergency. And it's a great thing to do.
Also this week, another Democrat from Massachusetts, Congressman Seth Moulton, says he's considering a run for president.
When I look at my four-month-old daughter and say, I don't want her growing up in this world, I feel like there might be an opportunity for me to do more.
And as we heard, former Republican governor from Massachusetts, Bill Weld, says he's also considering a presidential run.
We have a president whose priorities are skewed towards promotion of himself rather than toward the good of the country.
But the president says he's just doing what's necessary to protect the country. And we're going to unpack all of this, so let's dive right in. And to help us break it all down, we're joined by Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, nice to be here.
Always good to have you. Also here with us is John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and a blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, welcome back to you as well.
Nice to be here.
Okay, so let's start with what we saw from President Trump earlier today. Here he is again from the Rose Garden.
And what we really want to do is simple. It's not like it's complicated. It's very simple. We want to stop drugs from coming into our country. We want to stop criminals and gangs from coming into our country. Nobody's done the job that we've ever done. I mean, nobody's done the job that we've done on the border.
All right. So he declared a national emergency. John Carroll, I'll start with you. What's your response to this? Obviously, this is going to lead to pushback from the Democrats, lawsuits. What do you make of this?
Right. I mean, this is pretty much an unprecedented move on the part of Donald Trump. National emergencies have been declared before, dozens and dozens of them. Even national emergencies to move around military money have been called. George H.W. Bush called one in right before the Persian Gulf War. George W. Bush declared a national emergency after the 9/11 attacks. They were shifting around military money in response to current events. Donald Trump is doing something that is really end-running the separation of powers in terms of the legislative branch's ability to appropriate money. And what he is doing essentially is breaking down the separation of powers and assuming for himself something that that the Constitution does not allow him to do. So this is going to be interesting. Also, you know, at one point, Donald Trump called this kind of move dangerous, unconstitutional, and impeachable when Barack Obama was using executive orders. So this is something where Trump is way out on a limb, and we'll see whether the courts saw that limb off or not.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we know that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, two Democrats, of course, they put out a joint statement calling this a power grab. And some in the president's own party, among them Senator Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, for example, have been outspoken critics of declaring this emergency. Arlene, where do you see this taking us?
Well, it's partly laughable. Everyone anticipated that there was a high likelihood that Trump would do this. So no one is really shocked. The question is whether there was an implicit or explicit agreement with McConnell that I'll accept this bill, but then I'm going to say I want an emergency declaration and you have to back me up, which, of course, McConnell did, in fact, capitulate, even though prior to McConnell saying he would agree, Republican senators like Collins and Tillis and Roy Blunt had all come out and said, don't do an emergency declaration. The irony is that not only is it not an emergency, but Trump essentially admitted that today in his press conference. No more than 3 moments after he said, I'm declaring an emergency, he goes on about how, well, I didn't really need to do this because I could do the wall anytime, take a longer time. I just wanted to do it faster. So he thoroughly undercut the action he was assisting he needed to do.
He also made it very clear that he expects this to end up in the courts. Here's a little bit of what he said.
And we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the ban.
It's kind of a rhythm there, John.
It's a little Seussian, I think.
what do you make of this? I mean, he's got that right in the sense that it's going to go through the courts.
Right. I think the thing he's got wrong is he thinks he's got the Supreme Court in his pocket. And even the conservatives on the court are very, very reluctant to allow this kind of poaching in terms of the separation of powers, to allow the executive branch to expand its reach in that way. I think is something that that most of the court is going to find unacceptable. We'll see, but he's confident that the Supreme Court is on his side. I think the only people who are really on his side are Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh at this point. You know, he's got this cable cabinet that he's appealing to, and it's really leading him astray in many ways, I think.
You know, there's also another variable, which is there's been a lot of talk in D.C. about the fact that the National Emergency Act allows Congress to disapprove of national emergency declarations. And if, in fact, that happens in the House and it did pass, which is likely, then the Senate apparently would trigger a mandatory vote in the Senate, which could ultimately block the emergency action.
And lead to a Trump veto,
because it probably wouldn't be a veto-proof vote in the Senate, right? Yeah, interesting. One more thing I want to bring up about this, then move on, because we've got a bunch of other stuff to talk about. The president claimed during this press conference that Democrats have been lying about how drugs get into this country. Here's what he said.
And when you listen to politicians, in particular certain Democrats, they say it all comes through the port of entry. It's wrong. It's wrong. It's just a lie. It's all a lie. They say walls don't work. Walls work 100%.
Now, here's the thing. According to the DEA's 2018 drug threat assessment, the vast majority of drugs come into the country through the southern border do, in fact, come through ports of entry. So I want to say that, make sure I said that clearly. The vast majority of drugs coming into the country across the southern border do, in fact, come through ports of entry. So it sounds like this is another case where the president is rejecting data provided by his own administration.
He's deeply invested in not letting the facts get in the way of policy.
Yeah. Well, you saw this press conference, which is the typical freewheeling Donald Trump press conference. The fact checkers were actually going to see a chiropractor afterwards because there were so many things that Donald Trump said that were either misleading or false. And it's true. He doesn't care for his own experts. He cares for only his gut instincts, which lead him to make decisions like this.
Yeah. And also, it has to be pointed out, this is one of the central promises of his campaign. And it's a promise that continues to animate his core supporters. So there's that to consider as well. But we need to move on because there's a lot of other stuff that happened this week. And I want to come to former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld announcing this morning that he's forming an exploratory committee. Arlene, what do you make of the former governor of this great state declaring essentially a challenge to Trump, a possible primary challenge to President Trump?
Well, I worked both for and against Bill Weld for many years when he was governor here. And I certainly like what he said today. I love the fact that he poetically but right on point said that Trump may have raw talent, but he doesn't use it in ways that promote democracy, truth, justice, or equal opportunity. That was spot on. And Weld is, of course, significantly brighter than Trump and more thoughtful and a heck of a lot more charming. But I think this is going to be an impossible task. I mean, yes, it's true he'll get independents votes and some moderate Republicans. But at the end of the day, I think Trump has a lock on the Republican nomination.
A lock on the Republican nomination, John. But we heard in the first segment, Fergus Cullen up in New Hampshire sort of made the point that maybe a challenge like this wounds Trump sufficiently and draws votes away from him in the general election. What do you think?
It's possible. I mean, you know, the thing about Donald Trump is, you know, he has a ceiling, but he has a floor as well. Mm-hmm. And his floor isn't going anywhere. The other aspect of this is Bill Weld may not get to challenge Donald Trump because there are rumblings in the GOP that they want to bypass the primary system this time around. In South Carolina, the GOP chair says, I don't think we need a primary here. We'll do whatever in the best interest of the president. Our Republican National Committee official has said, the RNC should just endorse Trump and forget about all this primary stuff. So that's going to be an interesting gambit if they go down that route, and whether there'll be backlash to that or not.
I want to come back, though, to William Weld and just sort of ask this question about how serious this is. Because on the one hand, he was a serious governor. He served for almost two terms. He was highly regarded. But since then, there's been a sort of quixotic nature to sort of the directions he's taking. I mean, trying to run for governor of New York, to then abandoning the party. I'm free at last. I'm a libertarian, running for vice president as a libertarian in 2016. Now he's back in the Republican Party. Arlene, doesn't this sort of, I don't know, detract a little bit from his credibility?
There is that pattern of what day is it or what year is it and where is Bill Weld politically. I saw that issue-wise. He, when he was first ran for governor in Massachusetts, some people heralded him the gay hero. Others challenged that, but he was on the cover of a gay magazine for being so wonderful. But no sooner was he in than he didn't want to support domestic partner health insurance benefits. He was for same-sex marriage before he was against same-sex marriage when he moved to New York and wanted to run for another office. So he's been a little bit all over the map on some things, and that's going to hurt him.
So let's move on to another Massachusetts politician. This is Seth Moulton, the congressman. He declared this week that he's taking a very hard look at running in 2020. He was asked for a long time, are you running? He said he wasn't. Then he said he wasn't sure. And anyway, here is what he said on Monday speaking at Salem State University.
We need new ideas in our politics. We need new leadership in our politics. I've been fighting to get new leaders elected the last 2 years. And that's why I'm looking at running.
So, John, another Massachusetts politician looking at running. What do you make of Seth Moulton's effort here?
Well, it's going to be interesting for Seth Moulton because he knocked heads with Nancy Pelosi very publicly, and Nancy Pelosi right now is a rock star in the Democratic Party. So I think he's going to be carrying that baggage. Interestingly, Rochelle Cohen in the Boston Globe, I believe yesterday or today, wrote about Seth Moulton, the only one talking about foreign policy in terms of the nascent Democratic field. But the other thing is, I would say 75% of the people who are jumping into the Democratic race for the presidential nomination are campaigning for vice president. And I think that Seth Moulton falls into that category.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned the thing about foreign policy, and he gave a speech on Tuesday at the Brookings Institute on the future of defense in America. He's a former Marine, of course. He did multiple tours of service in Iraq. Arlene, what do you think about that? I mean, is that a lane that could sort of open up to someone like Seth Moulton, the sort of foreign policy expert, I guess?
Well, he's got good credentials when it comes to being a veteran and having volunteered to serve. I don't think that necessarily makes him at all an expert on foreign policy, however. I think some of the people who have been in Congress and the Senate a lot longer would have that. So, yes, it does give him a lane, but I think he's not quite ready for prime time. He is, however, as John pointed out, there a lot of them are running for vice president, just not in name yet.
Really interesting, yeah. Well, on to a story that broke yesterday. So General Electric has announced that it's abandoning plans to build a 12-story office building in the Seaport District in Boston and will instead sell the property. The company has said it will reimburse the state's $87 million investment in the proposed headquarters. And this story comes on the heels of news that Amazon has also abandoned its plans for a new headquarters in New York after heavy pushback from local lawmakers and activists who are upset over the financial breaks the company was given. So two big companies in two big cities that made generous offers to bring the companies in. John, what's your reaction to this news?
Well, the GE move you could see coming a mile away. I mean, this is the incredible shrinking corporation,
yeah.
And they have been downsizing for a couple of years now. And so I think that it's no surprise that that they're going to back out. And unfortunately, what's happening is the 800 jobs that they projected that they would be bringing to Boston when they moved here from Connecticut has shrunk by over 500. So there may be 250, and a whole lot of them are already working here. So I think that, that's a disappointment that's leading people to reexamine these sweetheart deals. Down in New York, I mean, Amazon didn't even put up a fight. It was amazing that they just folded their tent. And a number of people are saying, you know, this thing was a charade all along, that this was a marketing move by Amazon. It was a data collection move by Amazon to basically figure out where they want to put their new warehouses and distribution centers. And essentially, they're not even going to replace the New York facility. Really interesting contrast with Google, which is building a $1 billion campus in New York along the Hudson River, and they are getting zero in incentives. So I think that Amazon looked bad here. Amazon didn't really want to fight because they didn't really care that much. And they walked out. And for Bill de Blasio to say Amazon's not tough enough to make it in the big town, you know, Bill de Blasio was one of the ones who engineered the $3 billion sweetheart deal. So, you know, he can't have it both ways.
Interesting. Well, so to come back to GE in Boston, here's Somerville Mayor Joseph Curtatone. He told WBUR yesterday that this is a lesson in how cities handle big companies that are considering expanding or establishing a presence in cities.
Because a major company comes in that you didn't expect or is looking for a place to be, you know, the challenge for us is to, again, take a deep breath, understand what we're trying to accomplish, and not just lead with giving away the resources that we that are so critical for our community success.
So, Arlene, does he have a point there that cities need to, you know, I don't know, think a little harder before they make these really sweet offers to these companies? What do you
Absolutely.
Think?
Absolutely. I think it's honestly, this kind of corporate welfare is egregiously inappropriate. I agree with Michelle Wu that there has to be a lot more transparency and a lot more stringent standards when they do that. And there need to be clawback provisions that if you don't do what you say you're going to do, you got to give back the money. Now, it appears some of those clawbacks may have existed here. But I really question why the deals were made to begin with, because there's been a bad history in this state of these things failing. 20-some-odd years ago, the state gave a tax cut special for Raytheon. They did one specially for Fidelity. And guess what? Fidelity took the money, and now they're in Rhode Island. You know, Raytheon promised to have jobs, a certain number of jobs. It never happened. So we've got to be careful about that. But I question the fundamental concept of why in the world we are subsidizing private corporations to move into highly desirable areas where companies are tripping over themselves to get a piece of action in that part of the city. Now, I understand an argument could be made if it was a depressed area of the city, if like, oh, we're going to move to Mattapan and help economic development, or we're going to do a kind of work that needs to be done, like renewable energy, wind, solar, whatever. But none of those are the case here. And I think this deal, both at the city and the state level, should those incentives, those subsidies should never have been made.
Well, anyway, it's ended up where it's ended up. So sort of back to square one in a way. I want to move on to a story that we learned about this week. According to a new study, Boston has the worst rush hour traffic in the country, worse than L.A. So here's Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation Stephanie Pollack. We talked to her earlier this week on the program. You can imagine the shock that she expressed about this study.
I think people who commute in the Boston area did not need a study to tell them that we have a congestion problem.
Okay, so I think we all agree that it's pretty obvious that we have a congestion problem. But, John, were you surprised at all that Boston is – and by the way, the methodology of this study was that it doesn't necessarily mean that Boston commuters have the worst commute. What it means that at peak rush hour, they're moving the slowest. And so that's how it measured it.
Right. And the estimate is, you know, they lost 164 hours. Those drive time drivers lost, you know, $2,200. I'm not sure how they calculated that. Just for the record, I walked here. So, so you know, this doesn't bother me. But what did confuse me was the response from Stephanie Pollack and from Mayor Marty Walsh. I mean, Stephanie Pollack says basically what people care about is their total commute time. Well, that's exactly what this is about. I don't understand that part. part. And Marty Walsh said, well, this is only 50% of the issue because, only 50% of the people coming in the city are in cars. Well, that's the whole point. So, Stephanie Pollack says, well, we really need to know why. Why is this happening? And you can look in a couple of areas, and one's Uber and one's Lyft. And a big one is the MBTA, which is like somebody's hobby that they lost interest in. It is just the most unreliable mass transit system imaginable.
So in defense of, and I feel like I need to step in here because we spoke to Stephanie Pollack, and in defense of her position, she made a big case that $8 billion invested in the improvement and upgrading the maintenance and tracks and switches and new green line cars and a whole bunch of things to make the MBTA run a whole lot better. I just want to put that out
there.
And that's what she says.
Not to get technical about it, but just this week, three of the four lines were down because of power problems. And it wasn't even cold. So, people have different opinions about this. I'm the minority view, probably.
I'm not sure. There are a lot of frustrated commuters out there who I think might agree with you. But Arlene, what was your response to this?
Well,
study?
I appreciate Pollard's thoughtfulness about we have to study it. And on the one hand, that can be fine, except the fact of the matter is this is not a new problem. It's just a problem that's getting worse and worse. And to me, this is a pay now or save later phenomenon. I mean, the answer is not rocket science. We need a lot more public transportation, significant expansion. In the business world, there's an expression where they say, you have to spend money to make money. Well, in the government world, sometimes you have to spend money to save money. And if they don't take care of the problem of the mass transportation now, when it's cold, it'll develop into pneumonia and it'll be a lot more costly later. That study said that it's costing drivers $2,300 a year in congestion costs. You take all that money and you put it into mass transit and you expand the MBTA and we'd all be a lot better off.
Well, I want to make sure we leave some time for the hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. John, let me start with you. What was your hubbub?
My hubbub is the state of absolute chaos at the Boston Globe comics pages.
God, thank God someone's paying attention.
Two months ago, the Boston Globe dumps 11 comic strips, gets a bad reaction from readers, comes back, reinstates four of them this week. That's only part of the problem. The other part of the problem is one of the comics that they kept was one called Non Sequitur. And on Sunday, they ran a strip that had hidden in it an invitation to Donald Trump to do something that is anatomically impossible. So this was something that started driving newspapers away from to dump Non Sequitur. The Boston Globe finally did it yesterday after about five dozen papers had done it. And they have brought back Zippy, which is a good call, I think. They also implied that there are more changes in the offing in the comics page. I say stop the madness, leave the comics pages alone, or else bring back all the strips.
Arlene, are you a supporter of Zippy? Or you can offer me your own hubbub.
Well, I'll point to a local newspaper where the Beacon Hill Times ran a great story this week listing what's going on next week, school vacation week, and the Freedom Trail. And they talk about all these wonderful events from history tours that you can take and you can celebrate Black History Month with an African-American Patriot Tour. There's free ice skating at certain times and days next week. There's a children's festival. You can go to King's Chapel and tour the bell tower where it was recast by Paul Revere. There are all these amazing things happening in the city. We're so lucky to live in a place with incredible history. I hope people take advantage of it and bring their kids to some of these venues.
All right. That's great advice. So here's my hubbub. It's about the Pawtucket Red Sox, the Red Sox AAA affiliate, which is going to be moving to Worcester in 2021. So the Globe, and I credit the Globe, they just posted an amusing piece about the perilous high stakes question of what to call the team. They're going to be the Worcester Red Sox, but what about the nickname, which is apparently really important part of the marketing? So the team invited fans to submit suggestions, and they've been receiving, I guess, over 1,000. So here are some of them, because I think they're great. The Worcester Meatballs. Is Worcester known for meatballs? I don't know.
Not to my knowledge.
The Worcester Tongue Slingers. I don't even know what a tongue slinger is. Okay, but I still like the sound of it. The Worcester Mitten Kittens. Who thought of that? And I don't understand what that, but still, it's amusing. So, and this suggestion must have come from someone in Rhode Island. The Worcester Traders. I like that. And here's some with a decidedly local flavor. The Worcester Chowderheads. The Worcester Triple Deckers. And, of course, the favorite of many, the Worcester, Mass holes, which I think I can say on the air. Anyway,
I hope so.
That way I just did. Yeah. So Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, thanks so much for coming in
today.
Thank you. Really appreciate having you. And John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, always great to have you.
Thanks. And what's wrong with Woo Socks? It's got a cheer already built into it.
That's a good one. That's a winner, John. That's a winner. Stay with us. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Boston is often described as a two-newspaper town, thanks to the work of the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald. But we should call it at least a three-newspaper town and include the important work of the Bay State Banner. For more than 50 years, the Banner has provided an important voice for Boston's Black community.
The Banner is amazing because it's our paper of record. It's where we can go to find out what's happening.
The Bay State Banner is very important for democratic discourse in the city of Boston.
It is Black press reporting stories of national and international and citywide interest that aren't being covered by the mainstream press.
So that was Malia Lazu, founder of Urban Labs, Banner columnist James Jennings, and arts editor Kay Bourne talking to WCVB about the Bay State Banner. Now, a new book goes behind the headlines to take a look at some of Black Boston's biggest successes as chronicled over the years by the Banner. They include, for example, the foundation of One United, the country's largest Black-owned bank, the construction of One Lincoln, the largest skyscraper in America developed by minority investors, not to mention big advances in education and political power in the city of Boston. The book was edited by Melvin Miller, editor and publisher of the Bay State Banner. It's called Boston's Banner Years, 1965 to 2015, a saga of Black success, which Miller says about the book that it offers a view of Black Boston that the mainstream media often miss.
When I started thinking about how the media tends to focus on the problems Blacks confront with racism, that's an important thing for them to do. But there's another aspect that is often ignored, and that is despite the obstruction of the bigots, Blacks get around it and accomplish an awful lot. And nobody has really been putting together the record of what has been able to be done. So being a Roxbury man, I had a good idea of who was doing what. And we, of course, running the newspaper, reported on things. And when I started putting together the accomplishments of some of my neighbors, it was astounding.
Hmm.
And so I said, we have to make a record of that.
Interesting. So when you talk about this record of success in Boston's Black community, what are you thinking about when you're putting together essentially an historical record chronicling that success?
Well, I looked at the success of people attaining personal achievement and the success of putting together strategies that would overcome racial barriers. And you can see there was a whole section there on plans that were put together to overcome racial discrimination in employment. That was a big, big, big thing. You know, there were always jobs for Blacks if you knew how to handle a mop and a broom, but there weren't many jobs in administration, or certainly there weren't too many Blacks sitting in the C-section of corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So when you begin to look at the kinds of jobs that were not available, then you want to see, well, what did we do to overcome that?
Yeah.
It's quite a bit that was done.
And in fact, you have a section on law enforcement in the book and talk about the challenges of getting Black officers onto the Boston police force and police fostering positive relations with the community. But for the first time now, the top law enforcement officials in Boston are all Black. Police Commissioner William Gross, Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins, District Attorney Rachel Rollins. So here's Sheriff Steve Tompkins during our criminal justice roundtable a couple of weeks ago talking about the importance of being in this role.
As a man of color, the reason I took the job is because there are so many people that look exactly like me in jail. You know, but for happenstance, I could be in jail.
So, Melvin Miller, I mean, there's an example of how things have changed in a big way for Black Boston, right?
Yes. Oh, there's been a substantial change. And if reading the book, you can see the earliest steps that created the opportunity for that change. When the banner first started in 1965, there are only about, I would say there are no more than 10 police officers on the whole force, if that many. So we put a record of the steps that were taken to improve the number of Blacks on the police force. That was the first step. And we went on from there.
Take us back to 1965 when the banner started. What was the goal and the mission of your paper?
Well, what inspired the establishment of the banner was that the Civil Rights Act had passed, and it was clear to me that now there was a law that pushed most of the discrimination that we had to face beyond the pale of protection. There was an end to discrimination in employment, education, and places of public accommodation. We thought that building on that basis, we should be able to do a lot more and developing an economic base to enable the Black community to move forward. That was a very, very tough challenge. I think we haven't really done that part. And I think, as we can see now, people are getting more and more interested about how to start businesses and how to become economically productive units.
It seems to me that one of the important things that the banner does as well is sort of reminding the mainstream media over the years, again, to get back to this idea of the successes and the good stories in Boston's Black community, because I think maybe this is changing for the better more recently, but for too long, I think the mainstream media tended to focus on problems
right.
in the Black community.
Yeah, and the disadvantage of that is anybody who stays any time in Boston knows that we're a city of winners. Look at our sports teams. We just love it when they win. Baseball, football, basketball, and occasionally hockey. So to be cast in the media as losers, which is what happened to Blacks, and unfortunately, because of the empathy Blacks feel for their brothers who have been damaged because of racism, we have focused so much on that that we have almost induced the media to record us as victims, as people who are incapable of moving forward. So what we have to do is we have to really show the other side too. Well, despite these awful conditions that people of color have to confront, we were able to do this. We knew how to get around those linebackers. We knew how to get past those good cornerbacks and catch the ball. And that's what this book is about.
I want to ask you about the important perspective that a paper like the Bay State Banners can offer. Yawu Miller, the Banner senior editor, for example, wrote about the opioid addiction crisis.
Right.
Right? And made the really important point about how the response to the addiction crisis changed when it became a white suburban problem as opposed to a Black urban problem. We've moved from a kind of get tough attitude to the current push for rehabilitation and treatment. Is that an example of this really important change of perspective that the banner would offer?
Well, absolutely. I don't know whether I want to claim total responsibility for that, but I think that really shows discrimination in play, how it works. If you look at the data about, for instance, the use of drugs is greater, has been greater among whites than among Blacks But yet you look at who's in jail for it, and it's disproportionately blacks. And the reaction of the public is, oh, my goodness, these people have an addiction. It's an affliction. It's and they want to treat it as a medical problem rather than a criminal event.
Yeah, right. But is that that's a good evolution in your view?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, now, unless people are crazy, how is it going to be just a medical problem for one racial group and an absolute criminal act for another? I think that we can move this around. Why do we keep seeing blacks as a problem? Let's look at how they improve the situation. We had a losing baseball team until they hired black players.
It's a good point.
Where do you want to send Mookie?
No, let's keep Mookie.
Okay, that's precisely it.
Yeah, right.
So let's extend this understanding mm-hmm. to other areas and see, we're not being smart. Why are we going to give up and send away all of our talent?
Well, speaking of success stories, we have more women of color on the Boston City Councilor at the current moment than ever before. And most mm-hmm. recently, one of those councilors, Ayanna Pressley, went on to become Massachusetts' first black congresswoman. What's your view on her success?
Well, I think that's fine. And but, I have a classical view about politics.
Yeah.
We haven't had blacks in any great number to look to. But we have had some, and that's been great. But I look primarily at what's your achievement? What have you done? Are you really helpful? Can you do the job? And while I think it's wonderful for her to win, the congressman who she replaced had been doing an extraordinary job for us.
Michael Capuano.
Michael Capuano is a friend of mine, and he's a friend of mine because of his effectiveness as a congressman. And to tell you the truth, I'm not sure in the long run it's a good idea for anybody to vote for somebody just because of their race or gender. Hmm. And not look at their record.
But in the case of Ayanna Pressley, wasn't it true as well that, among other things, she expanded the electorate? I mean, she waged this grassroots campaign and got a whole lot of folks out to the polls who really had never voted before. So, and that had a lot to do with her success.
Well, that's right, and that's how it works. And she won, and I'm glad. I don't mean to sound like I'm not impressed and delighted to have more women and people of color in public office, but I just want everybody to understand, to me, the color of your skin and your gender is not going to get it in the long run. It's what people of sense are going to look at is, what did you accomplish? And I think she knows that well. I mean, this is the exciting period. Now we'll see what she gets done.
It's going to be interesting to watch. The book has a section about black political activism in Boston, and I want to read a quote. "The continuing campaign for equality and civil rights has created the image of African Americans as people involved in a constant protest. Indeed, Boston has been in the front lines of the battles." Do you think that same enthusiasm, I guess, for political activism still exists today?
I think it exists. But I think the issues are so different.
Yeah.
We were talking about fundamental issues some time ago, but nowadays they're really subtle changes in policy, and I'm a little worried about whether or not the voters are going to really understand the issues enough to make the right decisions. Mm. I mean, to tell you the truth, I have a hard time understanding. I'll never figure out how voters can see a guy pull up in a plane that is big with his name on the side of it, as big as a commercial liner, and says, "I've come to help the poor people." And they sort of believe that. Mm. I mean, my instinct would not believe it.
Right.
Because
the big plane with the name on it might suggest that maybe he's rooting for another constituency.
Well, that's what I would think. And it was very disturbing to me that people could be taken in by something like that. The concept of the American dream is so great that it befuddles the mind.
Yeah. Well, Mel Miller, I have to say, looking at this book, reading through it, I come away with a view of you as, and based on what we've been talking about here today, that you're an optimist. Are you optimistic about the future of Black Boston?
Well, I am. But no, I'm optimistic about the future of Boston, period. And this book is not just about Black Boston. It's to give everybody an idea that, hey, we've got a winning team here that can carry us across the goal line. Let's wake up and do the things that are going to make it happen. Boston is the place that can set the standard for the rest of the country.
All right. Well, that's Melvin Miller. He's founder, editor, and publisher of the Bay State Banner. He's also editor of the new book, Boston's Banner Years, 1965-2015, A Saga of Black Success, which chronicles Boston's black history through the eyes of the Bay State Banner. Melvin Miller, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for the work you've done over the years, and thanks for coming in today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
And that's our show for today and this week. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.